This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Earlier this year, we brought you the series After Ayotzinapa, about a group of Mexican college students who came under attack by police on a stormy night in 2014. Six people were killed, and 43 young men disappeared without a trace. The case scarred Mexico, and it became a symbol of the country's national tragedy of missing persons and a legal system incapable of bringing criminals to justice. This Monday marks 8 years since the attack. Our series was produced in collaboration with the National Security Archive, a nonprofit research organization that exposes human rights abuses in Latin America. And in the months since it first aired, there have been major revelations about the case. New evidence has emerged that powerful government officials were involved in a cover-up, including members of the Mexican military.
El nombre de un militar vinculado con el asesinato de seis de los alumnos de Iguala.
Then, in August, the arrest of the former attorney general who oversaw Mexico's discredited first investigation of the crime.
Mario Caram was arrested on Friday, a day after a truth.
If you want to hear the original series, and you really should, you can find it under Reveal Presents on your podcast app. Today, we want to catch up on what's happened since. Reveal's Aniancy Diaz-Cortez takes us back to the night it all began.
This horrific night in September 2014 really does start out stormy and rainy. A group of about 80 college students are caravanning in a string of buses through Iguala, a city in southern Mexico.
En el camino, se...
On the road, I felt a kind of heavy vibe.
Pesado.
Everything was calm,
estaba
but
muy tranquilo de más.
I sensed something strange. But, you know, we kept going.
A student named Nico Barrera is on one of the buses. And a note, Nico is not his real name. We changed it because he's been threatened for telling his story. He and the other young men are studying to become teachers at a college commonly known as La Normal de Ayotzinapa. Tonight, they're on a field trip. But they're not riding school buses. These are commercial passenger buses the students have basically hijacked. I know that sounds intense, but in Mexico, poor rural schools can't afford their own buses. The bus companies and drivers usually go along and drive them where they need to go. The police may give them a hard time, even make an arrest. That's usually it. But something about tonight is different.
Then two or three police cars arrived, local police. They barricaded us, first from the front and then the back.
Nico and his classmates think, no biggie. They're almost expecting cops. Some students even have rocks ready to throw. But instead of arrests...
They didn't warn us at all. They just got down and started shooting. Shooting to kill.
We are students. We are not armed.
And that's when the first one of us was shot. I saw my compañero on the ground, lying in a pool of blood, convulsing, and the police just never stopped shooting.
On a different bus, another student we're calling Lalo Lopez stands up to the cops, and they shoot him in the arm. blood everywhere. So the students decide to surrender.
When we got off the bus, the police stood on the side of the door and started to pull us out and put our hands behind our heads. My arm was hurting me, and then they started to throw us down on the ground.
The next thing Lalo feels is a gun barrel on the side of his head and a cop saying,
"What if I kill him?" And I thought, well, this is it. And then, just seconds later, he moves the rifle away from my forehead, and that same guy calls an ambulance.
The ambulance arrives a few minutes later, and Lalo is taken to the hospital. As they're driving away, he's able to glance back.
That was when they started to put my compañeros in different police vehicles. I could see it. My compañeros were just crying. None of them said a word.
From inside the first bus, Nico Barrera sees this too. Police push the students towards some pickup trucks and make them climb in the back, one leg over the tailgate and then the other. They force them to lie down. The trucks move out. The cops ride in the back and on the sides, their feet on the students' backs. When the night is over, six people are dead, and 43 students, including the ones Nico and Lalo saw being taken away in trucks, are gone. To this day, we still don't know what happened to them. One of the students who's been missing these past 8 years is the son of Cristina Bautista Salvador, Benjamin.
Benjamin Asensio Bautista is del cuarto de él.
This is his room.
De pasar mucho tiempo.
A long time had passed. I would see his room, and I felt like I couldn't go in. It made me sad and everything. And one day, I made the decision
dormir en su cuarto.
To sleep in his room.
Sentirlo más cerca a mi hijo.
To feel closer to him.
So every night, she slips into his bed, imposing her loneliness onto his space. And every morning, she leaves it. Clothes, shoes, hair gel, exactly how he left it when he went to college in 2014. When Doña Cristi and the other parents first learned about the missing students, they assumed the cops in Iguala had them in custody. But they didn't. Days passed and there was no news. In a frenzy, all the parents made their way to the state capitol with photos and birth certificates. They filed missing persons claims and demanded answers.
¿Y qué le decían, Cristi?
What did they tell you, I ask her?
Nada.
Nothing.
Authorities didn't seem all that concerned. All they did was swab the parents for DNA and take blood samples. But that wasn't enough for the mothers and fathers.
We went to Mexico City to march.
Within days, the families take to the streets. Hundreds of people join them. The families fear they're being lied to, that the government isn't doing enough to find their children. As a response, the federal government promises to get to the bottom of what happened. But parents like Cristi are so skeptical that with the help of their lawyers, they get a renowned Argentinian forensic team to work on the case on their behalf.
It was October 27, 2014, when we arrived to the site.
Mercedes Doretti leads the team. Everyone calls her Mimi, and she's there to work alongside government authorities. Weeks after the attack, they get a lead. The missing students may be dead, that their remains are at a garbage dump. When Mimi gets there, the scene is surreal.
We're in this gigantic hall full of garbage, which is very weird, right? There was an entire wall of like 40 meters all full of garbage.
Her team gets to work. They set up a perimeter at the dump. But after just a day or two, a government official comes over and says they have to go to another site immediately.
And that's when they took us to the Rio San Juan, where there was another completely different scene.
It's a small river, and near the riverbank, there's already a Mexican forensics team well into their work. They're cleaning and laying out burnt remains on the ground. The remains came from a plastic garbage bag that had been pulled from the water.
I remember very distinctly I saw this fragment of bone that was very different from the rest because it was way bigger and it was almost not burned. It immediately caught my attention because I thought it was very different from the rest and because I thought if in this bag there is more like this, we're going to be able to get DNA and so we're going to know if these remains belong or not to the students.
And so Mimi sets that bone aside, feeling reassured. It's her best chance at testing to find out who these bones belong to. Then federal agents show up holding two young guys by the scruff of their neck. One has eyes that are black and swollen.
The face of the guy, I always remember that. He seemed absolutely terrorized.
And there in front of dozens of people, this young man starts shaking. And in a whisper, he begins to confess.
We brought the students up there to the garbage dump. We killed them. We burned them the whole night.
Mimi finds the whole scene unnerving.
And that's when I thought, is this torture here? For me, it was a red flag there.
But as far as the Mexican authorities are concerned, they're on their way to solving the case. In January 2015, 4 months after the students disappeared, the government declares they've cracked it. That's Attorney General Jesus Murillo Caram. He begins to explain the findings of his team, and it is terrifying. The students were taken by corrupt local police and passed off to a group of criminals named Guerreros Unidos. They forced the students into pickup trucks, took them to the garbage dump, and shot them one by one. The gang members threw the bodies down a steep hill of garbage, then covered them with tires, wood, plastic, and finally, gasoline, and burned the bodies for 16 hours. They put the remains into plastic garbage bags and took them to a nearby river. There, he says, they dumped out all the remains except for one bag, which they threw into the shallow water. That's the bag that had the bone laid out when Mimi arrived at the river. And the attorney general says that a DNA lab had matched the bone to one of the missing students.
Alexander Mora Venancio.
This match, Murillo Caram explains, proves that the rest of the charred remains belong to the other students. They're closing the case. And Murillo Caram ends the press conference by declaring this theory la verdad histórica.
It's la verdad histórica de los hechos.
The historical truth. The message to the families is clear. This is finished. You need to turn the page. But to Doña Cristi, it's not. She remembers watching the press conference on TV.
We were having dinner and we just stared at each other.
¿Cómo?
We didn't believe it. We couldn't accept it. All we could think was, this is a historic lie.
Instead of putting the case to rest, the government's response leads to more outrage across Mexico.
The Mexican government, it's hoping this case will go away. And the case doesn't go away.
That's Jim Cavallaro. He was with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights at the time. It's part of the United Nations in Latin America. In a very smart move, the parents and their lawyers reach out to Jim, demanding a new independent investigation to prove that the government's theory is a lie.
There's a sense that this is going to be extremely politically detrimental, if not devastating, for the Mexican government, but possibly to the level of seeing a Mexican government fall.
The outcry for an independent investigation is so intense, the government has no choice but to give in.
So I think the Mexican government engages in a bit of a gamble, but a gamble they think they're going to win and that they need some kind of cover, which is we invite in the commission, see families, see media, see opposition. We have a commitment to human rights and we will do this the right way.
So immediately Jim gets to work, pulling together who's who of Latin American experts, people who investigated massacres, forced disappearance, and indicted paramilitary groups.
So we had folks who were not gun-shy.
The five experts call themselves El Grupo Interdisciplinario de Expertos Independientes, or GIE for short, which is how we'll refer to them. On March 2, 2015, the GIE arrive in Mexico. They head straight to the Ayotzinapa Teachers College and get to work. Francisco Cox, a Chilean lawyer and human rights expert, is one of the team.
We went out and we had like this huge, how you say, escolta?
Bodyguards.
Yeah, but I mean, they were like police officers with huge machine guns, and they all had their face covered. And this is something that Mexico does a lot, which is the state shows you its power.
For the experts, it didn't compute. Why would the government need masks and machine guns when it's visiting poor rural parents whose sons are missing?
So the contrast of Mexico, to me, was right there.
Even though the experts are from Latin America, they're outsiders in Mexico, trying to crack a super sensitive case. Each of them told us over and over again, no entendíamos a México. We didn't understand Mexico, not really. They need an insider to help them. This is where a young Mexican lawyer, Omar Gomez Trejo, comes into the picture. Up until now, he's been working as an observer on the case for the United Nations, but he wants to be more involved. Ayotzinapa has become an obsession for him. So when he reads about the experts coming in, he realizes he knows one of them.
And then we went to go grab a beer, and then we started to talk, and then he tells me, Omar, we're thinking about finding someone to be our anchor in Mexico. And I tell him, don't look anymore. I'm here.
Omar walks away from his comfy UN job for a temporary contract with the GIE. They give him the title of executive secretary, which basically means booking flights and keeping the calendar, taking minutes at meetings. But his role quickly grows, especially after his bosses suspect they're under surveillance at the fancy offices the Mexican government set up for them.
We ended up making Omar's apartment our office. So that's how committed he was.
So we would work around the clock, living only for lunch or dinner, and then we would work some more, and then eventually everybody would leave, and I would go into my room and play video games, you know?
And the next day, they'd start again. The deeper they dug into the case, the weirder it got. The Mexican government's account of the crime, the so-called verdad histórica, wasn't lining up with the facts. The government insisted the students were riding in four buses, but security footage from the night showed five. There was a lead that pointed to a possible connection with a drug cartel smuggling heroin to the U.S., but authorities never followed up. Then there was the fire at the dump.
Basically, the historical truth existed on the premise that 43 bodies were incinerated to a level that there was no organic matter left in that dump.
That's world-renowned fire scientist José Torero, who the GIE brought in to investigate the case. The government stated that the boys were so badly burnt, the DNA could only be matched to one student.
You know, to be able to incinerate 43 bodies, you needed a fire that was basically enormous, and it would have completely incinerated all the garbage in the slope. There was no way you could have had that fire in that place. Impossible.
Over the course of the next year, the GIE write up two reports explaining their findings. Both implicate the government in lying, planting evidence, and forcing confessions. Before making the final report public, Francisco Cox and the other experts decide to first tell the parents.
When we went to present the report, we did it in the school at Ayotzinapa.
Doña Cristi, whose son Benjamin disappeared, was there.
Lloramos. Ellos lloraron con nosotros.
They were just so sad. We cried. They cried with us.
Destrozado.
It was soul-crushing.
And that day, it was... Oh, man. I asked for their forgiveness, because we hadn't accomplished the main objective, which was determine what had happened to each one of them, of their sons. every time I remember that. Sorry. It's one of the most emotional times of the whole process.
The very next day, the HIEE schedules a press conference to present their findings publicly. They know the government's reaction will be intense, and their diplomatic immunity is about to end. They worry about being indicted, or worse. So the experts decide they'll leave the country after the press conference.
I remember we were all very nervous. I mean, we were very, very nervous. And we walk into this room.
The room is filled with press. The parents are there. Hundreds of others, too. The government was invited, but no one shows up. Just a few empty chairs in front of the podium. And before Omar can even get started, the parents start shouting.
No se vaya. No se vaya.
Don't leave. Don't leave. The entire room is a chorus of these words.
Era durísimo. O sea, tenía ganas de llorar. O sea,
to listen to them shouting, really wanted to cry.
O sea, no se vaya. Terminen esta historia que están haciendo.
Finish the story you're making.
¿Quiénes lo hicieron, no? O sea,
tell us who did it.
No se vayan, porque si ustedes
because
se vayan,
if you leave the people responsible,
lo que quieran, ¿no?
Remain free and can do whatever they want.
When things quiet down, Omar begins the press conference, which goes on for 2 hours.
Es un espacio para la verdad y un reconocimiento para las víctimas de los hechos acontecidos aquella noche.
When it's over, Francisco Cox and the other 4 experts are ready to go. They'd pack their things and book their flights home. But they're worried about what could happen to Omar.
Omar was the weakest link. He was a Mexican. We weren't comfortable with that situation.
So they huddled together, then tell Omar.
It is Francisco.
And so he tells me in his Chilean way.
Buen chileno huevón, tienes que irte de tu país, güey.
You have to leave your country.
Dimensiona las cosas, de verdad.
And then he said, like, do you think I should leave, like, for a couple of months? And I said, like, no, but I think you need to leave, like, for a long time.
The message sinks in. Omar rushes home to his apartment and packs what he can into 2 suitcases. He pays what's left on his lease. And the next thing Omar knows, he's on a plane headed out of the country.
With Omar and the independent investigators out of the country, the parents have little hope that they will ever find out what really happened to their sons. But a surprise development will bring new hope. You're listening to Reveal.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Omar Gomez Trejo no longer felt safe in Mexico after he and a group of independent experts exposed a cover-up by the government. So he fled to the U.S. in 2016 and moved into a tiny apartment in Washington, D.C. with a few things he managed to pack.
After I left Mexico, I dragged around two suitcases, a couple of books, my camera, my Mexican wrestler mask, things that were symbolic for me.
Omar had been invited to join a small team working on the case at the Organization of American States in D.C.
And then I get to Washington, and they hadn't done anything about the case.
Nada.
Nothing.
And so Omar decides to take lead on the case. He starts combing through the Mexican government's case files, hundreds of reports and interviews, looking for key facts, witnesses, contradictions. It takes over Omar's life and his apartment.
My apartment was covered in papers. I would scribble things on them. I would say to my friends, okay, go in. Don't look at the walls.
His friends think he's kind of losing it, his head in clouds of smoke from chain smoking. When he takes what he's learned back to his co-workers at the Organization of American States, they don't take him seriously. They tell him,
come on, Omar. You are not a CSI. This is not your job.
But Omar can't stop. He's looking for any and all threads to pull. Then one day in 2017, he's invited to a dinner by one of his old bosses from the case. And there, Omar meets Kate Doyle, our partner and co-producer for this story. Reveal's Aniansi Diaz-Cortez explains Omar and Kate had a lot more in common than they could have imagined.
Kate remembers showing up at that dinner at a Mexican restaurant like it happened yesterday. Minutes into their meal, Kate and Omar start talking about Ayotzinapa. Omar about how he's been reading the Mexican government's enormous investigative file, and Kate about what she's been digging into.
Oh my God, what did we not talk about on this case?
Kate investigates human rights crimes at the National Security Archive. It's a nonprofit research institute in Washington. She'd gotten involved with the case when the lawyers for the families of the missing students contacted her. After that dinner with Omar, they decide to combine forces and work on the case together. They share information and brainstorm next steps. It turns out that Kate had been looking into this really intriguing lead that the Mexican government had just ignored. And it came from a drug investigation in Chicago. Kate's work eventually led her to this man.
My name is Mark Giuffre. It's G-I-U-F-F-R-E, for the record. I'm a retired special agent with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. To me, with the students, what drives it home, where were they sitting when this all started? They were sitting in buses.
Mark first learned about the missing students from a piece in Time magazine that he read a few weeks after they disappeared in 2014. At the time, Mark was deep into an investigation of a heroin smuggling operation between Mexico and a suburb of Chicago called Aurora, and it involved buses.
Mexican passenger bus companies, they would go to this location warehouse in Aurora, and they would be serviced at the warehouse.
According to the DEA, the men were working for a Mexican drug cartel called Guerreros Unidos. That's the same group that Mexican officials were blaming for the disappearance of the students. Mark's team had been tapping into their texts for more than a year.
We were intercepting conversations, it being unloaded, yet we're unloading it right now. So we knew from the codes they were using that heroin loads were coming up in buses and that bulk cash millions and millions of dollars was going back down via the same method. We looked at our data, our intelligence, the intercepts, more than 2,000 kilograms of heroin came to Chicago in a one-year period of time, which is a unprecedented, mind-boggling amount.
In the days before and after the attack on the students, these kinds of text messages were going back and forth between gang members in Iguala, where the students disappeared, and the suburbs of Chicago, where heroin was being delivered in passenger buses. Kate knew the DEA file on the case included transcripts of those texts and that they could help identify the attackers. So she filed freedom of information requests and worked with Omar to lobby for their release.
We meet with the Justice Department. We meet with members of Congress. We meet with the State Department. We call the U.S. Attorney personally. All kinds of creative ways that we could try to push on that door to get information from the U.S. government about what they knew.
But the U.S. government wasn't budging, and neither was the government in Mexico. With the international experts gone, it doubles down on its version of the attack on the students, the so-called verdad histórica, or historical truth. And it launches an all-out campaign to discredit the work of Omar and the experts, the report that exposed a giant cover-up by Mexican politicians, police, and members of the military. The parents of the missing boys are outraged and do everything they can to keep the case in the public eye. They march, speak to the press, and try to meet with government officials, but they're turned down every time. In April 2017, the parents try to force a meeting with Mexico's Secretary of the Interior by showing up at his office. Doña Cristi, who lost her son Benjamin, was one of them, and remembers arriving at the building and seeing it closed off by a metal fence.
They began to launch tear gas at us. And when I looked around, a young protester that was with us was badly hurt, drooling, crying on the ground in pain, until he fainted. Then I saw some girls that had Coca-Cola, and I knew that Coke helped with the pain, so I asked them, please, please, can I have your Coke? And I ran to him and poured Coke on his face and mouth, and he woke up. It was terrible. All we wanted was to demand a meeting with officials, but they greeted us with tear gas.
Omar follows the news in Mexico from D.C. It's painful to watch the case collapse without being able to do anything about it. But by 2017, things are starting to shift.
¡Viva México! ¡Viva México!
Presidential elections are coming up in 2018, and a leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known in Mexico as AMLO, is leading in the polls. Doña Cristi remembers going to one of AMLO's rallies in the area where the students were attacked.
Andrés Manuel López Obrador was on the stage, totally blocked off, and security would not let us through. Then he saw us, and he told security, let them through. And I remember I spoke,
Andrés Manuel López Obrador, por si llega a la presidencia,
if you become president, what are you going to do for our case?
¿Qué va a hacer por el caso Ayotzinapa?
I think the question touched his heart.
Le pegó en su corazón,
he teared up and said, because if I become president,
por si llego a la presidencia,
we will find out what happened that night.
Se va a esclarecer los hechos.
In July 2018, AMLO wins in a landslide.
On the streets of Mexico City, they celebrated a victory more
with
than
AMLO in power, Omar feels it's safe to move back to Mexico. And in early 2019, he does. A couple months later, the new president announces he's going to reopen the Ayotzinapa investigation. Kate remembers catching up with Omar about it at the time.
And I said, so tell me what's going on with the case and what do you think? And he said, well, you know, they're looking for a special prosecutor and they've asked a couple of people and they have said no, basically. They don't want to do it. And he said, I think I'm going to put my name in for it. And I said, wait. What? You're going to put your name in for special prosecutor, but don't you have to be a lawyer to do that? And he was like, I'm a lawyer. And I said, wait, you're a lawyer? I didn't know you were a lawyer.
Omar Gómez Trejo, maestro en derechos humanos. Omar Gómez Trejo
fue secretario ejecutivo.
Omar Gómez Trejo como fiscal.
And he gets the job. In June 2019, Omar is sworn in as special prosecutor. It's a head-spinning turn. After fleeing Mexico and spending almost 3 years in exile for pushing back on the government's original investigation, Omar will soon be in charge of a new investigation. It's a big change for us, too. All of a sudden, our main source for the story, who'd been pushing to hold Mexico's government accountable, now represents the government. He can't be as open with us as before, but he doesn't cut us off either. He tells us the early days are brutal because the prosecutor's office, known as the Fiscalía, is filled with many of the same people who had hidden the truth about the case. One day he's given a file with some very sensitive information about people who worked for the previous administration.
I put the file on my desk, and at one point I get up and go talk to someone in the office about something. And when I come back, the file isn't there.
He goes to building security, and they get the surveillance video. It shows someone from his staff entering his office, picking up the folder, and walking out with it.
Después voy, lo confronto.
And so I go to him, I confront him.
Niega la información.
He denies it. And my folder is sitting right there in his desk. I grab my file, go talk to his superiors. They don't want to do anything about it. That's when I realize I have to take much more drastic measures. And I begin firing people.
After purging his own office, Omar focuses on what he's supposed to be doing, figuring out who was involved in the attack on the buses and in the cover-up of the crime, and his most important job, looking for the missing students. In his first year as special prosecutor, he goes on a couple dozen searches, each of them an emotional roller coaster.
Probably today is the day, and it's not the day. And you're going back to your house, to your office, to say, well, just keep looking.
Then he tells us about this day in November 2019. It starts off like most mornings, with Omar waking up before 5, greeting his bodyguards, then sliding into his bulletproof SUV. But instead of going to the office, they head toward Iguala and pick up one of the sources he's been talking to. This man was allegedly involved in the attack.
Y la fuente de ahí nos acompaña hasta el lugar.
And the source from there takes us to...
Es la Barranca de la Carnicería.
Do you know what Barranca de la Carnicería is in English?
It's the butcher's ravine.
It gives you chills, right?
Omar's source leads the way through the butcher's ravine and points to what looks like remains. A forensics expert confirms it's a human bone. Months later, in June of 2020, a DNA lab matches the bone to a student, Cristian Alfonso Rodriguez de Lumbre. Within a week, Omar's meeting with Cristian's family. Here's Luz Maria, Cristian's mother.
And they started to tell us that they found a bone fragment. Well, two little pieces of bone.
De un hueso salió la identidad de su hijo.
You're notifying the family about this little bone, saying it was found in such and such place with so and so characteristics, and all this work was done.
Que era una parte de su pie derecho.
It was part of his right foot. I was out of it, in a bad, bad, bad place. And then I snapped out of it and said,
un ser humano puede vivir sin ese pedazo de pie.
It's a very small fragment. A human being can live without a foot. And he tells me that's true. It's like they were telling me that he was dead.
¿Qué dices ahí?
What do you say to that? Nothing.
Nada.
The searches for the missing students are only part of our talks with Omar. He also tells us about his investigation into the cover-up of the crime, about finding videos that show forced confessions and torture that lead to the wrongful imprisonment of people.
Se ve a Carlos Canto, uno de los detenidos, asustado, maniatado, con los ojos vendados y siendo torturado.
Omar finds evidence that high-ranking officials were involved in falsifying evidence and forcing confessions. Tomás Cerón, the head of the original investigation, was one of them. Cerón worked directly with the attorney general. Omar gets a warrant for Cerón's arrest, But before he can serve it, Ceron flees to Canada, then Israel. Kate and I share information, too, about what we learned from the DEA's investigation into the buses and the heroin and cash flowing between Mexico and Illinois.
So you have said the buses, forget about the buses.
No.
Okay,
not
well,
like that.
All right, let me just...
We remind him about the text we've been trying to get through records requests, and he decides to petition the DEA from his end to get them released. That's where things stood when we released our three episodes about the Ayotzinapa case in January. But a lot's happened since then.
When we come back, Omar's investigation goes into high gear and ruffles the feathers of some very powerful people in Mexico. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. It's now been 8 months since we aired our series After Ayotzinapa, and a lot has happened with Omar Gomez Trejo's investigation. Here to talk about it is our partner, Kate Doyle, with the National Security Archive. Hey, Kate.
Hey, y'all.
And Reveal's Anianzi Diaz-Cortez. Anianzi.
Hi, what's up, Al?
So let's start with the buses, which you just mentioned. What did Omar do after you reminded him that the DEA had intercepted texts between drug smugglers?
So, Al, after that conversation with Omar Gomez Trejo back in 2021, he went to the Justice Department and asked for access to the investigative file from the Chicago operation. But they didn't give him any information. That all changed in January. According to Omar, after our podcast aired, he told us that people in the DEA listened to it. He even made the joke that, like, finally they understand the story because it's in English. It's in their language. And when he showed up for a meeting in Chicago, they treated him like a rock star. And he told us it completely changed his relationship with the DEA. They ended up giving him access to the complete file to Guerreros Unidos cell in Chicago, which was a huge shift.
And has access to that case file from the DEA led to anything concrete?
Oh, yes. One of the founding brothers of Guerreros Unidos, a guy named Adán Casarrubias Salgado, or Silver, as he was known, was extradited to the United States in May on charges of conspiracy and drug trafficking and money laundering. Silver was part of the gang in Mexico orchestrating the shipments of heroin to Chicago when the Ayotzinapa students were disappeared. His name is all over those text messages the DEA intercepted. Since Casarrubias' extradition, he's pleaded not guilty, which means he'll probably be tried in U.S. federal court. And if that happens, we could actually learn new information about what happened to the students.
Okay, so there's been some progress on the U.S. side of the investigation, but how about in Mexico? Weren't the international experts brought back in under Omar?
Yeah, that's right, Al. Four of the five international experts were rehired under this new investigation by Omar. And one of the things that they have all focused on in this new round is the military's involvement, not only in the cover-up, but in the crime. For a long time, people suspected that the military played a role. But the military in Mexico, it's untouchable. Under this new investigation, the GIE, well, they've been able to question soldiers. They were given access to military archives and even went on some installations. And in March, they found something huge. Evidence in those archives that implicates the military. Video footage from a military drone. The experts made that public at this huge press conference. Of course, Kate was there.
I was, and it was amazing. It was held in one of those old government buildings in downtown Mexico City, and it was full to the brim with press, TV cameras, government officials, and of course the mothers and fathers of the disappeared students. The experts set up a screen at the front of the room, and the entire room was silent as we watched this play-by-play of this drone footage. The military had sent the drone over the Cocula garbage dump, that same dump where the previous government claimed the boys had all been taken and killed and burned in a giant fire. Well, now we're watching this dump hours before the official forensic teams arrived later that day, but it was full of government officials, federal police, members of the Marines, the prosecutor's office, even the attorney general himself, Murillo Karam, were there. And they seemed to be manipulating the site. They were kicking things, dumping bags of stuff, burning fires. At some point, this huge helicopter comes right into the frame and lowers over the dump without landing. And as you can imagine, everything started blowing up into the air, debris and garbage, and then it just flies away. So you couldn't help but think as you're watching that this is some kind of deliberate doctoring of this supposed crime scene.
So wait, the military was there planting evidence, taking part in the cover-up?
They were, and that's not all they did. Thanks to the investigation, we know that the military was receiving intelligence, like a play-by-play, on the students' movements in real time, not only as they left the school that afternoon of September 26th, but that night during the attacks, during the gunshots, as they were being kidnapped, and for days afterwards.
Yeah, and a lot of that information is contained in a new report that the government just released outlining some of the incredible evidence that Omar's office has uncovered. The report shows that at least six of the 43 students were alive for 4 days after they were taken, and that an army officer named Jose Rodriguez, who was the commander of the base in Iguala at that time, ordered the gang members to kill them. Rodriguez is a retired general, and he's just been arrested for his alleged role in the students' disappearance.
It's hard to comprehend. In the three-part series, you guys go deeper into it and found a government official named Tomas Zeron, and he was the lead investigator for Mexico's previous government, but then fled the country after Omar's team connected him to torture and planting evidence. Is Zeron still hiding? And if so, is Mexico any closer to getting him back?
Yeah, Al, Zeron is still in Israel. We've learned that he's living quite a luxurious life. He's in an apartment that's owned by an Israeli businessman who's connected to a major spyware company. Zeron used spyware in Mexico, including Pegasus, to spy on the international experts, on Omar, on the parents who he was supposed to be working for, including Doña Cristi, the mother of Benjamin that we follow in this series. This all happened as he was investigating the case, as the government's lead investigator back in 2014 through 2016.
Omar is still working on getting Zeron sent back to Mexico to stand trial. And last August, he flew to Jerusalem to meet with Israeli prosecutors. He had sent them all this evidence he gathered against Zeron, and he wanted to confirm that they had everything they needed. While Omar was out of the country, there was another huge development in the case. The Mexican government arrested Tomás Zeron's boss, the former attorney general, Murillo Karam. But something puzzles us about that detention, and that is, why did the government wait for Omar to be in Israel to carry it out? Why wasn't the special prosecutor in the Ayotzinapa case the one to announce such a major arrest? We're still not sure why it went down that way.
So there's still so many unanswered questions here.
There really are. And there's another worrisome aspect to this whole thing. Omar Gomez, his team, the experts, they have really pulled the curtain back on the military's role in this crime and in the cover-up that followed. But their progress in closing in on the military is taking place in the context of a government that has done almost everything it can to enhance the powers of the military. President López Obrador has granted the military huge new powers that Mexicans have never seen before. The armed forces in Mexico now controls all airports, all customs, all telecommunications. It's kind of difficult to square that the investigations move against the army with a president who seems to have no limits as to how far he's willing to go to promote and protect the military.
So how do the parents of the missing students feel about how this is going?
So Al, this week it's been 8 years to date of the night of the crime. So of course, there's just this general sense of exhaustion and frustration. On the one hand, under Omar's lead and with this new investigation, there's these spectacular arrests happening. It's really giving the impression of real progress toward justice. On the other hand, not a single person has been tried and convicted for the crimes of this case. Sure, people are detained and put in jail, but no one has been successfully brought to justice. And also, you know, from the very beginning, these parents have been chanting, "Fue el Estado," it was the state. And so now this, you know, new government is saying, yes, it was the state, fue el Estado, here's the report. Which to a parent, to Doña Cristi, is like, well, you know, thank you for telling me what I've known for 8 years. And I tend to look at it from Cristi's perspective, who we follow throughout our series. What she's told me is, I need to know what happened from the minute he was taken away, who gave the order, where he was taken, if he died, how he died. And if he did, I need to have remains so I know where to cry. Until I know what happened to my son, I will continue to march and protest and try to find the truth.
Thank you both so much for this work. Kate Doyle with the National Security Archive and Reveal's Aniancy Diaz-Cortez, who is also the lead producer for this week's show. Taki Telenitis edited the show. Thanks to John Gibler, Tom Blanton, Megan DeTora, and Claire Dorfman from the National Security Archive, and to Laura Starcheski, Lisa Pollack, Ariana Rosas, David Rodriguez, Bruce Heal, and Ike Shrieskandaraja. Special thanks to Santiago Aguirre and Maria Luisa Aguilar from CentroPro, and Maureen Meyer from the Washington Office on Latin America. To check out our original three-part series about this case, go to Reveal Presents on your podcast app and look for After Ayotzinapa. You can hear the Spanish version of our investigation from our partners at Adonde Media. Subscribe to Después de Ayotzinapa wherever you get your podcasts. Nikki Frick is our fact checker. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy the Great Mustafa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. Our post-production team is the Justice League, and this week it includes Claire C. Note Mullen. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our interim CEO is Robert Rosenthal. Our interim executive producers are Brett Myers and Taki Telenitis. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.